Hey, what's happening? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is August 15th, a Monday, and this episode is brought to you by my fantastic motorcycle sponsor, the one and only El Cajon Harley, located in Southern California. I want you guys to make sure, whatever you do, do not buy your motorcycle from anyone else except El Cajon Harley. Let's show them that this sponsorship rocks and that you guys appreciate them sponsoring the podcast, helping out with the expenses here. Super cool. Also, El Cajon Harley is the only dealer that will have the brand new 2017 Harley demo fleet before anybody. September 3rd and 4th, you'll be able to ride the brand new Harley Davidsons. We don't know what's coming out yet, but next Tuesday is the dealer show. And then that night, next Tuesday night, you'll be able to hit the Harley Davidson website and find out what's coming out. I'm hearing rumors there's a new motor, the Milwaukee 8 motor, which I'm curious to see. And, you know, there's always rumors around what Harley's going to put out. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but I'm hearing new motor, dual head oil cooled engine. We'll see, a 107. But whatever it is, El Cajon will have it, and we'll be able to go test ride on September 3rd and 4th. I'm going to be down there 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day. They're the first ones to have the brand new bike. So let's head down there, ride, hang out. Demo event days, be the first to ride the new 2017s at El Cajon Harley.
Gonna give myself away every morning.
All right, how are you guys? It's Monday. I'm just rolling in from the fucking airport. I was in Salt Lake City last night. Did a one-off at Wise Guys. And what a fucking great, great club. Great owner. Great audience. Everything about it was fantastic. Salt Lake City, man. They got some comedy fans out there. And thanks to everybody that came out. And you know, from the podcast, people are showing up saying, hey, I love your podcast. I came out because of that. That's so fucking cool. Putting some asses in the seats, man. It's always scary when you fly a couple hours and then you get to the hotel and you just hope, man, I hope people come. I hope fucking people come out, man. I don't know. I'm not like some guy that just fucking sells out ahead of time. You know, there's not like massive tickets. Sales and then I go, oh, I got it. It's going to be packed. Cool. So it's always a mystery. And I'm, you know, I all's I care about is people at the show, man. There's nothing worse than doing comedy to nobody. It's not the money to me. It's not the, whatever. It's not trying to be famous or whatever. I just want to do comedy in front of people. That's all I give a fuck about. And quality crowds that are into comedy, not just some bar gig where people are hijacked, like, oh, what is this, you know, whatever. So it's great to see after 4.5 years of doing podcasting that people are starting to hear it. And a lot of you that tune in every week, thank you so much, man. It's so fucking cool. Keep leaving the reviews and subscribing. Last week, I got 6 reviews. Woo, killing it. 6 reviews in 1 week. Whoa. I still say to this day, if everyone fucking that listen, even today, took 1 minute and said, great podcast on iTunes and click subscribe, you would be looking at a number one show. You guys are in charge. You guys are in charge. I just put the material out there and see what goes down, and you guys are in charge. I want to give a shout out to Chad Pollock. He donated this week to the podcast. Very, very cool. Thank you so much for the donation. I also want to thank everyone that ordered the Dean Del Rey Marshall shirt, and they should be in your mailboxes by now or Monday. What a great shirt. I actually love the shirt. The quality came out great. The shirts are super soft. The print looks cool. And I don't want to put any garbage out. I want to put out a shirt that I would actually wear. So I hope you guys love it. And thank you for that long wait. Since the Alice in Chains tour happened, I couldn't get the shirts out right away. And I think I'm going to do another run of them because a lot of people missed it. They were sleeping, they were smoking weed, whatever they were doing. And then as soon as I send them out, they go, where do I order that? And I go, oh, the last 2 months I've been talking about it on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Where the fuck do you magically miss that, those posts, but you see all the other ones? Anyway, thank you, Utah, for coming out last night. Wow. Oh, and Mary. Oh, she flew all the way out. Hold on a second here. Mary Stevens had her brother, brought her brother to the gig, flew out to Salt Lake to see the gig. Doesn't get any cooler than that. And there was some serious Del Razors in the house also. So thank you, everybody, that came out to the Wise Guys. What else? I made a major rookie mistake, and that's why this podcast is up late today. When I was booking the flight a couple weeks ago, I was obviously running, burning the candle at both ends, not fucking paying attention, and booked my flight. I booked a 6 a.m. flight Sunday morning out to Salt Lake, and then I book an 8 a.m. flight back Monday morning, so I'm just doing a quick, you know, 10-hour, 15-hour turnaround. And I wake up Monday morning, head to the Salt Lake City airport, realizing I booked an 8 p.m. flight for Monday. I'm like, oh, that's not going to fucking work. What a rookie move. I never do shit like that, but that's what happens when you're tired. If I was working at a steel mill, I'd probably be missing an arm right now. Just be, you know, making some bad judgments while I'm sleepy. Not enough sleep. Some fucking subway exhaust or whatever, subway fumes from New York. I go book a flight and make a major mistake. So I immediately got to fix it. So I get up at 4 a.m. this morning. I go to Salt Lake City Airport, get on the standby list, $75 fucking dollars, and wait to get on the 6 a.m. flight. And I'm just about to get on. It's 5:55. And the lady goes, that looks good. There's one person not here. You're going to get on. And out of fucking nowhere, I see this guy running in his socks. He's got his work loafers in his hand and his tie flying, and he's just running. Wait. And I'm like, get out of here. He fucking runs right in with like 1 second to spare and walks right on the fucking plane, man. I'm just like, oh. And I look at the lady, I go, all right, what's next? She's like, well, there's a flight at 11 o'clock. I can get you on. I'm like, oh, it's 6 a.m. right now. I got no sleep. All right, fuck it. Let's do it. She books me. This flight is a nightmare. It goes from Salt Lake to San Fran, then an hour wait for the connection, then San Fran to L.A. Total backass. But I got to get home so I can put the podcast up. So I'm like, all right, I'll fucking do it. I booked the flight. I'm sitting there just waiting. I eat an $8 oatmeal. Eight fucking dollar oatmeal. God, $8 oatmeal. And then about an hour before the flight, or 2 hours before the flight, it says flight delayed due to fog in San Fran. The plane coming from San Fran to Utah. There's fog. Classic San Fran. That airport every morning has massive fog. And now I won't be able to make my connection when it lands because it lands at fucking the same time I'm supposed to be getting on my connection in San Francisco. So I'm fucked there. Go back up to the lady and go, looks like the connection's no good. She goes, let me see what I can do. She starts digging around. She goes, oh, here's a flight leaving in 30 minutes on Delta. I can move you. which I didn't even know you could do. I was booked on United. Now I'm on Delta, and it's a fucking better plane. It's got big TVs, big seats, and I'm on. I run to the gate, and I get on and fly home. Now I'm like, all right, the podcast is going to be nice, and it'll be in time. I'll be home at noon, and all good. I land at LAX, go upstairs to hit an Uber. For some reason, there's some kind of Uber meltdown. I wait an hour and a half for a fucking Uber. And you're going, why don't you take a cab or something? Yeah, I went downstairs. 7 million people trying to get cabs because something's wrong with Uber. Finally, to the rescue, my boy Steve Henry, who was our guest last week on Bitchin', he says, look, man, I'll come pick you up and fucking right on, man. Steve Henry, that's you. There's no better friend. You want to test a friendship immediately in Los Angeles or maybe wherever you live. Just call your friend and go, hey, pick me up at the airport right away. I've got about, I don't know, maybe 700 contacts in my phone. I could have called every one of them in the thing and probably three would pick me up. Lucas Hurl, Biddlecombe, and Steve Henry. Those are your friends. That's how you know who your friends are in LA. Real friend will pick your ass up and be like, you owe me, dog. And there it is, man. So I'm home. And I'm about to get this episode up for you. You're like, okay, get to the episode. I know who's coming on. I've been reading the tweets. Yeah, today, incredible guest. My guest is blues guitar god and super collector Joe Bonamassa. And to say that this guy is great on guitar is an understatement. He is an absolute fucking legend in the blues world now, a newer legend, you know, carrying the blues flag. And he also has one of the most insane equipment collections I've ever saw. If anybody knows anything about me, some of my old friends know that I absolutely worship vintage music equipment, especially Fenders and Les Pauls, but mostly Gibson 1959 Les Pauls. If you're just a casual listener and you don't know anything about music or anything, that guitar to me is the most iconic piece of rock and roll machinery there is in the world. It's exactly what I love in life. It's a piece of art with the way it's made and the way it looks and the ultimate design. Nobody to me ever topped what a Les Paul looked like, especially slung low like Jimmy Page, down to your knees, that classic junky rock and roll style. The flame, the way the flame tops would light up. If they moved one way, there was no flame. And then they would move another way and you go, whoa, look at the fucking flame, man. The sunburst color, the way they all faded differently. Some have no bursts. Some are old vintage lemon bursts. Some are like tobacco bursts. They all look different. They smell incredible. They all have this weird smell like a VW's interior. They don't smell like that, but if you, any VW you get into back in the 60s and 70s had the same fucking smell. They're the Hemi Challenger of instruments. They're the Todd Shore of guitars, you know, meaning the art way. I love 59 Les Pauls. If I had crazy money, I would probably own as many as I could. They're all different, as you'll hear in this episode. Joe has many, many 59s, and you're going to find out how rare and special that is, because you don't just go down and pick one up for a couple $1,000s or whatever. I think they sold for $300 back in 59. I should have looked up that number. I used to know it. I used to know everything about guitars. I used to be totally obsessed. I knew pot serial numbers. I knew what solder joints, if they were cut or redone. I knew about cloth wiring, original pickups, original tuners. I knew everything about these guitars inside and out. I still know a little bit, but over the time, I've let that slip, and I need room for remembering my bits. So as you need room in your brain, other stuff goes to the side, but it comes back very quick. And as I sat in this man's house, which I thank him for letting me come to his house and see this equipment, I was in awe. I was seeing exactly what I would love to have if I was a rock and roll or guitar star. I would just have exactly what this guy had. And he has every piece of gear I've ever wanted. And it's awesome. And I want to thank him for doing the show. We didn't know each other. And a great thing that's happening with this show is when people do the show, they tell other people later on, like, yeah, that's a legit show. You should do it. And it's starting to get me some next level guests that I couldn't get before that because I didn't know the people. I know you're going to enjoy this, and welcome all you guitar nerds. It's probably your first time here because you're a big Joe fan. Welcome and check out some of the old episodes of all kinds of different guitar gods on here, and musicians and comedians and friends and all that stuff. Anyway, let's get down to it. Before I get to the episode, I will be in Arizona August 31st through September 4th. I will be headlining House of Comedy, and I want to give a shout out to my other sponsor, Earthquaker Devices, perfect sponsor for this podcast, especially today. If you do play guitar, bass, keyboards, or any kind of instrument, you're going to need a stomp box, and what better stomp box than Earthquaker Devices, handmade in Akron, Ohio. They've got an incredible Instagram page too. Check it out, Earthquaker Devices. Call them up, tell them you heard about it here on the show. They're going to hook you up with a sweet deal, and they're fantastic pedals. They got all kinds of crazy different ones, like the Cloven Hoof, still my favorite one, the Cloven Hoof. The Park is a great one. Of course, you got to get yourself a stomp box if you want to be rock and roll. Thank you, everybody. Leave those reviews and subscribe. Let's get into it right now. Joe Bonamassa. All right, here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. Fantastic guests. Introduce yourself today.
My name is Joe Bonamassa, and I'm a guitar collector.
You're a guitar collector, to say it.
And an occasional guitar player.
Yeah, fucking great player. We're here, Laurel Canyon. Don't get any more rock and roll than this.
Yeah, I mean, without giving out the actual address up here, but it's a very historical place in the world, to be honest with you, for music. The Jim Morrison house is close, the Joni Mitchell house is just up the street, the Zappa house is just across the street, and it's the DNA of music is in these streets, and it's where all the guys used to come out and they wanted to smoke their weed and hide, you know? And this is what it was back in the 60s.
It truly is for me or you or anybody that's into rock and roll, immediately when you move to LA, like I was telling you when we were coming here, it's like, you just go, well, I'm going to live in Laurel Canyon. That's where everybody lives, It's so rock and roll.
It is, but of all the canyons, you start looking at Coldwater, Topanga, or,
Beachwood.
I mean, it's not as crowded as, the lots are kind of set up in a really strange way, in the sense that you get these like triangular lots, and the grid, it was not gridded properly to begin. It was just all kind of ramshackle when it was set up. So that's why the houses are kind of spread out a little bit in comparison to, if you go up on Sunset Plaza, those $5 million behemoth palaces that they build up there, they're like right on top of each other. And it's like, I don't want to spend all that money to live, what your neighbor's doing, having for breakfast. It's like, not cool.
I'm in your studio right now. You've been showing me your gear. I'm an absolute fucking gear freak.
Right.
I always was a gear freak. To me, growing up, rock and roll was Jimmy Page, Dragon Pants, and the Les Paul.
And the Les Paul. All this is an extension of my childhood, growing up listening to music, you know, all these books you see on the table. I know this is a podcast, but, you know, this table in the studio is full of old guitar books that I had when I was a kid, you know, and I would, you know, just, you know, go, you know, I would read the Gibson Electrics book cover to cover, the original Tom Wheeler book cover to cover, you know, twice, three times, and you know, I just wanted to be around it. And my father at the time was dealing guitars and buying and selling, and you know, so
did he have a store?
He had a store twice. Yeah, he just.
So what year was he doing that? Like early, like Norm style?
No, he started in the 90s.
Oh, 90s.
And then he reopened at the end of I want to say 2010, and then he did that for 3 or 4 years, and then decided it was just retail is tough, and you know, if unless you have people hustling guitars for you, you know, guitar shows are extremely, it's so hard to buy stuff, and it's so hard to, you know, just do consistently find new inventory. Yeah.
The internet wipes it out.
The internet wipes it out, and you know, now everybody's selling stuff on you know, Reverb, and I still go after, I'm still a G-Bass guy. I was there. I remember when they first set that up.
Yeah.
And it was like three dealers on G-Bass, and you could look at the entire inventory that everybody had for online, you know, dial-up internet speed for, there was 30 guitars on G-Bass. Now yeah. It's thousands, and, you know, Reverb has really made it into an extension of that, where, you know, they're selling studio gear, they're doing lessons, and they really, you know, Reverb, I thought what they were doing is really clever as far as you know, taking a guitar trading site but making it more than just, you know, well, either you buy it or you don't, you know.
It's
you can actually get on there without purchasing anything, and there's some interesting content that they do, and there's always activity. So they were up here a couple of weeks ago, and of all the stuff in here, the guy up here freaked out on the Dan Electro Twin 15.
Really?
Which is an amp that I bought from an accordion shop in Minneapolis, and apparently it's very rare. I don't know much about, you know, any other amplification company other than Fender, mostly Fender, and a little bit about Marshall and some old Gibson stuff. But apparently the Dan Electro Twin 15 is the rarest amp I own. So
wow.
I was like, wow, okay.
What did he say it was worth? Did he say?
I'm not sure. I mean, I couldn't imagine it's worth more than a couple $1,000s, but it's one of those things, it's like, try to find another one. You
yeah.
know, because you see, apparently, you see like 100, you know, Twin 12s to one Twin 15. And if you plug a Les Paul into the Twin 15, thing roars like a Blues Breaker combo.
Wow. You know,
I bought it for $300.
Wow.
I bought it from my accordion shop. $300, and I bought the amp next to it, which is the Ampeg Gemini 2, which was
I love those.
Honestly, more classic records were done on an Ampeg Gemini 2 than, you know, other than a Fender Twin. That was a go-to studio amp for a lot of the studios, both in New York and here in Southern California. So guys, Tommy Tedesco wasn't going to schlep an amp with him. Just plug into whatever. And a lot of times what you're hearing on those classic, you know, Wrecking Crew records is either a Fender Twin or Concert or whatever they were using, or an Ampeg Gemini 2. And it's
wow.
got great reverb and tremolo. I bought it from the same guy two years later. Also $300.
Unbelievable.
I was like, he goes, I'll just charge you the same one I did for the Dan Electro. He held it for me.
You got a couple of those old boogies over there, huh?
Those are not boogies. Those are Jim Kelly's.
Whoa, they look like boogies, those early Boogie Mark ones or whatever.
Yeah, those are seven, a pair of Koa 1978 Jim Kelly FACS two-channel. And
wow.
it's basically Jim is a good friend of mine. It's basically a double deluxe. It's a 60-watt deluxe, and these happen to have the original JBLs. Now, again, not giving the land of my house away, there's about 35 stairs and quite a walk to where my studio is.
Oh my god!
Of all the amps that I brought up these stairs, those Jim Kellys were by far the heaviest, and it's a single 12, 60-watt. With a JBL, I swear to God, I thought I was gonna die. They're the heaviest amps I own, and they're unbelievably heavy, but they sound great. I always loved Jim Kelly amps.
I used to play Matchless, you know,
right.
And they're the heaviest amp on the planet. And three flights of stairs in San Fran. And
Brutal.
I just had the John Jorgensen combo. It's super rare. It's blue sparkle.
Right.
And when you look at it, it looks like the smallest damn. And then you grab it, and it's like, what the fuck is it? And, and that was... like unheard of, you know. The first boutique amps were just so heavy.
So heavy. Well, you know, I always say never trust a light amplifier. Like, you know, the high powered twins that I use, the 59s, and even the basements. You pick up a Fender Tweed Twin, high powered twin, those things are 80 pounds. You know, yeah. it's a pound per watt. And you know, the thing is to get the headroom out of the amplifier, you need a gigantic transformer. People try to do it with less, and they try to do this linear amp shit, and quite frankly it doesn't have the big clean headroom. And the classic tones that I like are frankly the sound of volume and headroom and the guitar turned down a little bit. And then it's like, you know, if you watch that movie It Might Get Loud, Jimmy Page demonstrating Ramble On, he goes, here's the rhythm part, and it's the front pickup on, you know, and he just had the Marshall dimed or whatever he had, super lead through a single cabinet, and then when it goes into the chorus, he hits the lead position that's a little bit louder on the guitar's volume, and all of a sudden the amp's roaring. You go, that's, you can't do that if the amp doesn't have any headroom. If it's just distorted, you know, or collapsing straight away, you can't get those dynamics.
Your gear is mind-boggling. I mean, the collection is insane. Let's talk a little bit about how do you find the gear now? Do people just email you like, hey, I found this? Or when you were on tour back in the days, would you hit pawn shops and everything? Because that's what I would do. I'd buy blackface amps and shit.
Yeah, not back in the days. Currently, we have a term around here called Guitar Safari, and it's like, what it is generally on the days off, my guitar tech Mike Hickey and I, we just get in a car and we go hit music shops in these towns, and just to see. And you know, I set sail each tour, and especially in America, and I have five of these gigantic trunks. They were made for like drum hardware, but they're gigantic. You know, you could fit a whole refrigerator in them. And I have five of them in the front of one of the trucks. And I can guarantee you, by the time 3 or 4 weeks go along, I can fill about 4 or 5 of those trunks.
There's still stuff out there.
There's still stuff out. Like, I got a 64 SG yesterday.
Saw that.
From the original owner's widow.
Now, how did you find that?
She found me.
She found you?
She knows that I collect guitars, and she's a big fan. She's been to my shows. And she found me, and she goes, I really like my husband's guitar played, and if nothing else, going into a good collection. I said, I'll give it a good home. And I'm, you know, it's the George Harrison SG, you know, it's like the 64. And, you know, a lot of, you know, I have some very rare stuff, guitars and amps, and all of this that you see, I know people can't see it, but all this stuff that I have, none of it's eBay. There's not a single eBay purchase, because each of these amps and guitars and signs has a story, and I could put a place to it, and where I got it and who I got it from.
Yeah.
And that's the stories are more valuable than the objects. If you just sit on eBay and go buy it now, and then you go, where'd you get it? I got it on eBay. And it's like, well, it doesn't really have a story, does it?
Yeah.
You know, but like a lot of my, you know, custom color Fenders are from the original owners, you know, a couple of my Sunburst Les Paul's original owners, Gold Tops. And, you know, that's got more to do with the collecting part of it than just having the item,
right.
You know? You can only play one guitar at once, you know?
Yeah.
You can only, you know, it's like, how many amps do you need to, you know, string together before you go, what are we doing here? But it's the story that you collect, and then the gear is an extension of that.
It's insane, man. I mean, I'm looking around here, and to me, it looks like blues pays pretty good.
I
got to be honest. I didn't even know who you were until around 3 years ago.
Right.
guy knows I love Carina V's,
right,
and Carina Explorers and 59 right. Pauls. And he sends me this video. He's like, "You seen this guy?" And I'm looking at it, and I go, I never heard of this guy ever. You're playing Just Got Paid, one of my favorite songs
right, on a
ever.
V.
On a V and at Royal Albert Hall. And right. I'm like, there's three things. Never heard of the guy, mm-hmm. sold out Royal Albert Hall, right. and he's killing it. You know
well,
what I mean?
Thanks.
But my point is...
That, by the way, the V in the corner, that's the same guitar.
Yeah.
That's the one from the Albert Hall.
It's so great. Now, my point is... You know, you've been playing since you were like 4 years old.
Right.
And you've played with big ass guys. You've toured. You've mm-hmm. done great records. And then as I start looking back into you, I go, oh, I know who the fuck Bloodline was. I remember when that happened. And then, of course, I know Black Country. But it was just crazy to think that somebody of your caliber had gone so much under the wire to me.
And you know the great thing about my career is we are able to, you know, I can there's no being an F or, you know, I always say like an M or N level celebrity. I'm like, you know, so down the people know me if I walk into a music store, and that's bad. But you know, the idea is I didn't get into this to be famous. I just wanted to collect guitars and be around nerd things. And you know, the guy in the suit is an extension. That's a character. That's a different guy that comes out at 8 o'clock at, you know, on show day. You know, it ultimately, you know, the way my career is set up is like, I can go anywhere in Los Angeles. Nobody gives a shit who I am. I love that. I love anonymity. I love being private, but I could sell at the Greek Theater.
Yeah.
You know, and I love it. You know, yeah, because it's the best of both worlds, and my fans know that I am that guy. You know, it's like I post a lot of photos on gear, and some people go, "Well, you're just showing off." I'm not showing off. There's a difference between showing off and sharing. You know, all my collector buddies, you know, like there was a de facto kind of it was Leo Fender's 107th birthday, and I know that a lot of my Fender collector friends that you know. Have Instagram accounts, and it's all just sharing, and I've learned a lot and made some good friends from it. You know, everybody was putting up their just best displays, you know, of Fender stuff.
Yeah, yeah, here it comes. Here's mine.
Like,
yeah.
You know, a gentlemanly one-upmanship, you know. But, you know, you do take some flack from people that don't understand. You just think you're just flaunting it. It's not that at all. It's sharing. There's no point in collecting it, hoarding it, and whatever if you're just going to keep it under this, you know. It's like, what are you going to do with it? You know, it's like,
yeah.
So what if you got 25 brown Les Paul cases in the other room? Who cares? You know what I mean? It's like if nobody sees the guitars, if they're never played, if they're not shared. You know, and
I think it brings people joy.
I think it does too.
I really do. And if people say if people say anything like that, they're just like jealous idiots,
yeah,
you know.
And we call it the loud minority.
Yeah.
It's usually the very few people. There's a few people that have the loudest voices, you know, like they'll say mean things or you know, or kind of lash out at stuff that they don't understand. It's like, dude, you know, it's a real easy solution. If you don't like something, just unfollow the account.
Just turn it off.
Turn it off.
Yeah.
Like nobody owes you anything. You know what I mean? If you don't like a picture of a Tweet Amp once a day, then unfollow.
Yeah.
And you'll never have to see another Tweet Amp in your life, but to sit there and troll stuff.
Well, they're just miserable people.
They're miserable people. And 99% of the times, not even 99% of the times, 100% of the times, Mike, they'll never say it to your face.
No.
They'll never say it to your face. But
not only that, but they don't even leave the house. They don't go to concerts or anything. They're not even in life.
Right.
They're just home clicking and hating.
So you know, it's funny. A friend of mine who works for a guitar company, we were talking about it yesterday. He was, it's like one of the biggest, loudest critics of this certain company, you know, signed up for the forum, the sanctioned forum, 4 years ago,
yeah,
and has 20,000 posts in 4 years. So they did the math. That's like, I think, 14 posts a day.
Wow.
Every fucking day for 4 years. You go, this person has nothing better to do than...
I mean, 14 posts of hate, you know?
Right, I mean...
All right, I got to shower, brush my teeth, and then hit the keyboards.
Right, and you know, a lot of those kind of people, they're self-appointed tone experts. They're self-appointed. And you start getting into it and you start looking these people up and they're quote unquote tone gurus, and they start these big pylons on artists and stuff that they don't understand, and you realize none of them gig.
Nope.
Nope. You're like, wait a minute. You know, it's like if you want to argue about tubes or what speaker harmonically within a certain frequency band is better, well, that's all fine. It's all fine. And maybe you hear the difference in your, you know, man cave or in your guitar room. Everybody has one, you know, who's into this kind of stuff. But the one thing that they don't talk about is the first time a snare drum is hit, all those harmonics go away because the snare drum is in the same frequency as your guitar. So
what else they forget to talk about? What? Writing songs.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
Where the fuck, who gives a fuck about any of this shit at the end of the day if you're not writing songs, you know?
And some of the best classic music that we love, guitar's out of tune.
Oh yeah.
Buzzes.
Yeah.
Plugged into whatever. You know,
whatever's
like,
there.
Do you think Hubert Sumlin cared about what he was plugged into enough to, does the amp work? You know,
yeah.
We got to cut Killing Floor. You know,
yeah.
It's like this song that Wolf wrote. Okay, plug into anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And it's like you see all those old blues guys, especially live, they tuned to the out-of-tune piano, but they had songs.
Yep.
And they had
they had vibe.
The gear wasn't front and center. You know, it's like, you know, Chet, the old Chet Atkins story, like, you know, Chet's in a music store and somebody comes up to Chet and recognizes him. He's playing a guitar and he goes, wow, Chet, that guitar sounds amazing. And he puts the guitar down on the stand and he goes, how does it sound now? You know, and it's like, it's true. It's like the gear can't play it for you.
Yeah.
You know, a Dumble amp will not make you a better player. If anything, I found a Dumble amp will accentuate how bad a player you actually are.
Is that right?
Oh yeah. They're super honest. You know, they're very articulate and you hear every nuance in your playing. And, you know, so people who go, well, I tried a Dumble, it wasn't for me. It's like, okay, they're not for everybody. I sold mine. I didn't like
it. You sold yours?
Sold all three. Yeah.
Really?
I got into high power twins and the Dumble started sitting around so much so that at one point in my old house, I had a single 12 Dumble overdrive special combo on the side of the television set, and I would sit on the couch and watch TV and I'd noodle through the Dumble at like TV volumes, and I go, really, Joe? This is a
that's your noodling.
Yeah, I think it's time to give it to somebody else who really could appreciate this and use it the way it's intended. So,
well, without Stevie Ray Vaughan, there's no Dumble mystique.
Without Larry
anyway.
Carlton or Robin Ford,
right?
I mean, those are the guys that put him on the map.
Right, Larry Carlton, yeah.
David Lindley, who's the other early Dumble guys? I almost bought his amp. It was Lowell George.
Oh yeah,
he came real close to
Little Feet.
He played a Dumble, and, you know, Bonnie Raitt had one, or has one, I'm not sure. Jackson Brown was a big, big proponent. I think Dumble actually lived in his house at one point. So Carlos Santana, of course, and, you know, I mean, like, there's a lot of classic tones that have come out of Dumble amps and you know, that kind of thing. But you know, I could also say I've seen Robin Ford play through a Fender twin in it and a pedal. It sounds like Robin Ford.
Well, it's like Billy Gibbons, you know. I put on his my buddy's his guitar tech. I'm backstage. I put on his $2 right. Gretsch. It's right. Lime green. I'm like, yeah, but where's Pearly Gates, you know? But he walks out, just comes out and starts up, you know, and you're like, oh God.
And it's that sound.
It's that sound. It's all in the fingers, is of course, as everybody always says, it's in the finger. It's the guy.
It's the guy. And Billy plays. He could play through anything and sound like him. It's really in his DNA and not in, you know, anybody else's. You know, it's like and that's the trick. It's like, you know, I when Eric Clapton sat in with me in 2009 at the Royal Albert Hall, you know, he brings a brand new low power twin reissue and a Eric Clapton signature Strat and a monster cable. And he plugs in, I think he set everything to 7 and it sounded like God. It sounded like the Blues Breakers. It sounded like all the classic stuff.
Wow.
And you're going, wait a minute here. I couldn't do that.
That's about $2,000 in gear. You know, it's like nothing.
And the twin was American Power, and he didn't want to stand in front of it, and he wanted it a little off to the side. And I'm like, okay. And it was like, that was a real lesson for me that you know, you start talking about which way cables are supposed to be wired. It's wait a minute. Like, yeah, these cats, the real cats could just plug into whatever and make it sound like it, make it sound like God. And that's the proof, you know.
Let's talk about the first 59 you got, the first one you got. You
Magellan,
got,
yeah.
You got six?
Six 59s and three 60s.
Unbelievable. So what year do you get it? How do you find it? What's the story on it?
My friend...
That's Elliot, the one you showed me inside.
Yeah.
It's a plain top.
Plain top.
Super light.
Yeah. 0829. Is the serial number, and it's my friend Elliot Michael from Rumble Seat Music.
Oh yeah, I remember Rumble Seat.
He's moving to Nashville and he's starting his shop.
Is he moving?
Yeah, he moved.
Was he at Ithaca?
He was in Ithaca and he was in Carmel at the same time, and he moved. And he was in Albuquerque at some point too, but he's moving to Nashville with his shop. And in 2000, the end of 2010, I see Elliot in Albuquerque and we hang out, and he's like. You know, at that point in time, after the market crashed and the Great Recession, as they call it, bursts were dead. Nobody was playing them. You know, they spiraled out of control price wise, and they crashed, and nobody was buying them.
Right.
And Elliot had a burst, and he couldn't sell it, which turned out to be Magellan. Just nobody was buying Les Pauls. And he's like, Joe, you should be playing a burst. I'm like, well, you know, I should also have a house made out of solid gold, and I should also, you know, drive a custom-made Enzo Ferrari. I go, these are great things in theory, Elliot, but in reality, you know, I can't justify, you know, 160 grand for a Sunburst Les Paul. He goes, here's the deal. Pay me $1 a week, and you just take it and play it.
No.
That was the deal. He says, pay me $1 a week. And I said, well, I could probably do better than that. And it started this whole thing where my career, it started to really... kind of take off around 2010, and so I was in a position where I could start buying, and a couple things happened is as I started playing the Les Paul, the 59s, he was astutely, I think, Elliot, you know, the market for the guitars started to kind of rekindle, and it was like it wasn't just because it in when the prices became stupid,
yeah,
$658, you know, like whatever, like just crazy numbers, and you know.
Did they get up there?
I think one was sold for. The rumor was one was sold for $7.5, but yeah, I mean, I've heard them selling for $600.
Wow.
$500, $600, $700, and you know, when you start getting into that, the pool of buyers becomes so shallow.
Yeah.
There's maybe seven people in the world that are.
Yeah, and they get one, and they put it in their house, and they're done.
I know. Guys that have 20, you know, or more.
20?
Yeah.
Like the guy in Japan?
There's a guy in Japan. They're all in there's multiple burst owners all over the world. Right. Minimal. So anyway, I get this guitar and I'm like, holy shit, I have a 59 Les Paul. I owe all this money. I just took on this debt and I'm supposed to play it. So I take it everywhere. I take it to Europe. I take it. Do all of America. I take it to Australia.
Are you carrying it with you?
Carrying it with me. And I'm fighting my way through Australian, flight, you know, rules. Where they won't let you carry it on. I'm like, I'm not checking it. I buy seats for it and, you know, go through that. I finally take it to London to play with Jack Bruce. Rest in peace, because he was doing this gig that Gary Moore was supposed to be on, but he had died earlier. Gary had died earlier that year. So they called me to fill in. Subsequently, Jack passed on as well. Anyway, and I finally get it back here to Los Angeles, and I realized that the guitar, which didn't have a name at the time, went all the way around the globe in like 80 days.
Wow.
And I was like, what am I going to call this? I called it Magellan.
Yeah.
I said, it's gone around the world, and, you know, I probably lost some hair on that deal, but... It was very stressful, but now I have a system where I get the guitars there safely, without worry. And
how do you do it now? Like shipping?
You just have to buy a seat for it.
Oh yeah, buy a seat. Yeah,
buy a seat, and it's honestly by the time if it goes cargo or freight, you know, in a special case and inside a case inside another case, that's a good way as well. You know, but the safest. Easiest way is just pony up and buy, you know, if you're in, you know, 38J by 38K, you know, and what they do is they're obligated to give you a seatbelt extender because there's nobody's buying seats for guitars So they think if you buy two seats, they think you're overweight.
Oh, wow.
So they're obligated to give you a seatbelt extender. So that's the story of Magellan. I've had that. And then the second one I bought was Principal Skinner, the Skinner Burst.
Yeah.
And then the third
one. That's the one that they did the replicas of.
And then the third one was Spot. Fourth one, I'm trying to
remember. Now, where are you getting those? Are people just hitting you up?
Well, you know, like I got two from a good friend of mine.
Are they all original? Pickups, knobs, solders, all that?
Yeah, I mean, the Magellan is all original. Solder joints are all original. Spot's had the pickups, the back pickup has been in and out. I have pictures of it with a double black in the 80s. So somebody put another double white in there. And honestly, the whole thing about solder joints and tuners and stuff like that, yeah, I mean, I have a few all original ones, pristine, not a screwed, you know, turn. Right. The thing is with bursts, a lot of times the 59s, they were Grovered at one point. The pickups have been in and out because they didn't care.
Yeah,
they
wanted,
this pickup doesn't sound right to me. Get another PAF.
Yeah.
They weren't worth, you know. So a lot of times, you know, when people start arguing over solder joints, it's like, guys, is the guitar real? Okay, as long as it's real.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's the wood and the top and the aging.
It's everything. You know, it's a real guitar. You know, like Skinner was all original when I got it, and the problem when I got it, it had no frets.
Oh.
What did I do? I refretted it.
You got it.
I play it. You know, and there's no reason to own these things if you can't play them. You know, it's like,
that's amazing that you play them. I love that.
I play my original Flying V. I have a 58 Amos, and when I got it from Norm, it had those itty bitty little 58 frets, and they were ground down right to the wood. And it's like, man, this thing would be a monster if it was refretted. And I said, fuck it, refret it. I don't care. And at the end of the day, I kept the original frets, and I can always put the original frets back in. But that's stupid.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean. To me, it's like there's no sense in owning. And when I got the guitar back from Joe Glazier, it was twice as loud acoustically and became an absolute monster. And I refretted it and never looked back.
Wow. So, do you play that one out live?
Play that one live, yeah.
We were talking a little bit about, of course, I love the Murphy Pauls. I always shout them out. I love Tom Murphy's work.
Tom is great. He's a real character.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I've never met him, but...
He's a real character.
You know, in 96, like I said, they go, oh, we were making Tom Murphy Les Paul, only 50.
He's the Billy Martin of Gibson.
Really?
That's the analogy. Tom is like, Tom and Gibson, you know, they need each other. But there's always a falling out. So every other time you see Tom, it's like, Tom, how's it Gibson? Yeah, fuck those guys. I'm not working there ever again. 6 months later, a new Tom Murphy guitar. You know, it's like he's been in and out of Gibson so many times. You know, like, you know, it's like. But I think now they're over the years. I think they've ironed out their. But I always used to be like, oh, I don't work for them anymore. I'm like, I thought you did last week. Oh no, I'm out. And then you see him again. Oh no, I'm back. So he's like the Billy Martin.
That's hilarious.
The Yankee reference, if anybody.
Now, when they did your guitar, and you got it back, did you think, wow, this is incredible? Because to me, I keep thinking the tops are just too flat. They don't have the dish, you know.
Well, they've been working. You know, the true historic is. I think what they're trying to do is to finally get the carve and a few of the things that have been overlooked correct. You're never going to make a 59 Les Paul because which one, they're all different.
Yeah.
Every single one of them is different. Neck angle, you know, and some of the original ones, they're kind of crappy. You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, you know, it is a guitar made by a human being. At the end of the day, it is a guitar that there was good ones back then and there were great ones back then. There's some good ones, you know, now, and there's some bad ones now. You know, there's some great ones that come out of the custom shop, and it's the nature of building instruments, you know.
Yeah. You like the one they did on yours? Do you play it live?
I thought the Skinner Burst came out great. I play a combination of the custom shop ones that they build for me and a lot of, you know, like in lieu of just getting a Skinner Burst, you know, whatever serial number, I get him to put my name in the fingerboard. So yeah. I have like a bunch of R, you know, like R9s and like that's you're looking at this is the newest one. It's a white 355 with a rosewood neck. and my name in the fingerboard. And they make great stuff. And
yeah, they do. It's my favorite, man. There's a dude over at Fender Custom Shop that's making some relics that are blowing my mind. Wilson, I think his name is D. Wilson or something on Instagram.
Yeah.
His work is incredible. I picked up some no casters that weighed like 2 pounds. The Swamp Ash is so old and aged and lightweight. It's all good stuff, and you can tour with it as a guy like, you know, that's not like on your level, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, that's a great thing about it. They are building some great new guitars. If anything, now, there's too many options.
Yeah.
There's too many. I mean, there's, you know, like in the 50s, a 50s Fender catalog looks like, you know, one of those old Scholastic news, you know, pamphlets that they used to, yeah. It's like 3 pages.
Yeah.
I mean, a Strat, Tele, P-Bass, you know, Champ,
Amplifier.
Yeah. There was like 30 items. Now the problem is there's so many different versions of the Les Paul. There's so many different versions of the Stratocaster. So many different versions of the Telecaster, 335, you know, and both companies are guilty of this. It's like, do I want a California hot rod Strat,
yeah,
or do I want a Carbonara, you know, infused? You're like, what?
Yeah,
the
it's
hell?
Crazy. Like,
it's a fucking Strat.
I go to the NAMM show and I go into the Gibson booth, mm-hmm, and I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait to see the Murphy Pauls and the stuff. They don't even have any of the good stuff there. I'm like, what's going on here, man?
I haven't been to NAMM in a bunch of years, but it's become like, you know, you just can't keep up. And I think there's too many options for the consumer going, you know, you just have to find something that speaks to you. It could be a Les Paul Studio. It could be whatever, you know, you could rule the world with anything. Put some humbuckers on a 2x4 and go.
Jack White style on that movie, I mean, and make it loud.
Yeah, you could rule the world with anything if you have some ingenuity and some creativity. And again, it boils down to those pesky things called songs.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, as far as the gear, you know, is concerned, you know, nobody cares, you know, what pedals you're using. You know,
it's not like, when they're listening to it in their car.
Not when it's a bad song.
Yeah.
You know?
You'd think like, you know, Fire and Water, you're driving in your car and you go like, listen to that amp. And, you know, you're just going like, listen to the song.
Listen to the song. And Paul Kossoff, I mean, he would do a mixture of, you know, I think I've seen him play Orange amps. He was a Marshall guy. I've seen him in the studio with a Super Reverb and a half stack. He just played, and it all sounded like him. No matter
totally
what you play, and that's the point. If the point is, you know, it you find your own voice and you try to write as good a tunes as you possibly can, and then, man, the sessions get a lot. Once you have a good song, man, the sessions are fun. Once you, if you're like the song's kind of lame, man, those grind on, you know, for forever.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I see. Paul's guitar's going up for sale. Are you going to get in on that?
Well, they tried to sell it last year. See, I don't really go after celebrity-owned stuff.
Right, but it is a cool ass.
It is a cool one. I know Arthur.
You played it. I watched it on video. How was it when you played it?
It's a wonderful guitar. I mean, half the neck's been broken off and then replaced.
Right.
It's the Backstreet Crawler guitar. It's not the All Right Now guitar. It's not the Fire and Water guitar. It is a wonderful... It's hard to even tell. It's probably a you know, mid 59. You know, there's no serial number, so it's
right,
judging by just the neck shape and the heel. You know, it's probably mid 59 ish. You know, it could even be as late as an early 60, but with that kind of wood, it's most likely in the 0600, 0800 range serial number. That's just speculating in my guess. I mean, the celebrity owned stuff, quite frankly, it's very difficult to evaluate, because when Danny Gatton's guitar came up for sale, I took lessons on it, and the original price that was quoted to me was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And,
right,
and I came back and I said, that's not going to happen in this lifetime, because I knew Danny.
Yeah.
You know Danny about all the guitars in the guitar.
99% of the people don't know Danny.
99% of the general public are not familiar with his music.
Yeah. Same like a Billy Gibbons one,
if Pearly,
or Jimmy Page.
Right. If Pearly goes up on the block,
yeah,
then everybody's in on the action. If Page decides to sell one, yeah, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
But people when you go free.
The Peter Green one.
Even the Peter Green one, they couldn't sell it. They finally ended up selling it to Kirk Hammett, which I think is a great home for that.
Yeah.
So ultimately it's very difficult to evaluate what the guitars are actually worth with the historical provenance attached to it. So I stay out of that because it's really easy to get spun up and overpay for things that are attached to a celebrity. The only celebrity guitar I own, other than the Howard Reed guitar, and not many people know who Howard Reed is either, is I own Terry Reed's Telecaster.
Oh, wow.
That he played in, he bought in on tour with Cream in 68. And I know it's Terry Reed's Telecaster because I'll give you one guess who I bought it from.
Who?
Terry Reed.
Oh yeah, there you go.
So, and it's the same guitar he used in all that stuff. And it's and Terry's a real legend in my mind. And I think his songs were so good back in the day. And he's a name that everybody should know. I don't really get spun up about who owned it before me because there's that pesky thing. It's like if I bought Eric Clapton's Strat, I ain't gonna sound like Eric Clapton. It'll sound no. like me. I played Blackie.
Yeah.
I played Blackie and I played the Red 335.
And that thing was a Frankenstein. It had a different ear and neck and a different body.
It was totally pieced together. And,
yeah.
And it's a refin.
Yeah. The nightmare, you know?
Well, there's no primer underneath the paint. And Fender always primed guitars, especially black ones. It was either white or, in the case of the Reed Strat, it'd be gold and silver. But, it was probably refinished when the body was refinished long before Eric Clapton bought it. And he bought it from Showbuds Music, which was right on Broadway in Nashville, right across the street from the Ryman. And Showbuds, they were also responsible for Steels. They had a spray booth. They were finishing stuff. They wasn't like this, and that's the other thing. It's like the myth sometimes gets perpetuated, and you actually have to look at the guitar. It's like, all those big celebrity guitars, they're not all original. They were tools. That's the guy's hammer.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
That was the guy's screwdriver. It's like, whatever.
Is there a 59 Paul out there that you go, I've got to own that one, and they're not cutting it loose?
No. I run when I can. I've come to the conclusion that I can play, it's like most of my guitars, I only use one at a time on the road. We used to take two, but one is plenty.
One on the road? Just one guitar?
One 59 Les Paul.
Oh, I got you.
There's a backup, and we average between 8 and 12 guitars for the tour. Different tunings and,
right.
It's like mine are now, they're just criminally underplayed now. The thought of just keep socking them away, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. If one comes up and, I can swing it or I particularly like it, then I'll go after it. But other than that, there's not one of those, it's not one of those things where I got to have them all,
What are they at now? Like price wise?
Depending on what you want. If you want to,
let's just say it's an all original, clean, nice flame.
I just heard one, go for four.
Four.
Generally, if decent, it doesn't have to be the world's greatest wood, but a real guitar, you're in the mid twos.
Wow,
you're in the mid twos now.
I love that story where Slash gets Joe Perry's, plays it for like 15 years, right, and then gives it to him on his 60th birthday.
That's all. Yeah, it was really. I thought that was very generous. Slash.
Yeah, yeah. Are you kidding me, man? But that's
one of our forum members, Billy Lysigian, I think he owned the Slash Burst for a while. These guys are East Coast, so I think Joe sold it in Boston.
Yeah, right. His wife did or something to the store.
And it ended up with Billy, and it's been through several hands, and then it ended up with Slash in about 1990, and then 10 years ago, whenever, he gave it back to Joe. Ultimately, That's. I thought that was really a great gesture.
That's unbelievable.
And if I was Joe Perry, he can play whatever he wants. I'd be rocking that guitar.
Me too. I can't believe it, right?
Who cares?
Plays that crazy ES-335 with the woman painted on him. Like, you're like, he had some health problems recently. I'd be like, I'll play this till I die.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be scared of it. Just go play it.
Yeah. I mean, how great would that be if he just comes out and you're like, that's the one from the, you know, live bootleg record right there. And you know, like, draw the line.
And it's like, you know, Jimmy Page still plays his 59. It's like, you can't be scared of him. That's the thing about the guitars. It's like, some people are scared of him. And it's like, and I always ask people, like, have you ever dropped a guitar? They're like, no. I'm like, well, and I'll hand him my guitar. Just, I go, don't start now.
Yeah.
You know, just, it's got to, you know, you treat it with the same, if you're careless with it, yeah, it's going to fall over.
Right.
But if you're, but, you know, I'm not careless with my reissues. So I'm not leaning up against, you know,
yeah,
whatever. And
the old school leaning up against an amp and then go have a drink in between sets at a bar gig.
Yeah, and then wonder why your headstock breaks. I mean, yeah. It's like if you're careful. I mean, I bring 59s to little club gigs I do in town.
No shit.
Yeah. As long as it comes out of the case, in my hand, go on stage, in my hand, goes back in the case, still in my hand, case never leaves my side.
Yeah.
Easy enough.
So great.
I never leave it on a stand. I never, you know, unless it's my guitar tech or somebody I trust, I'll sort it. I'll just tune it up and go.
That's badass. What's the best one you own, you think?
My personal favorite is the one we call Snake Bite. It's got a Bigsby on it.
Whoa.
And then it was removed, so it's got two little screw holes in the top, so it's got a Snake Bite. That's my favorite. Principal Skinner is my favorite. One of my favorites, 1951. Other one I just got. 2229.
You just got one?
Yeah, I got one 2-3 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
When I got home. 2229. That's particularly a nice one. We're going to see. I'm going to bring a couple to the studio next week and when we do the Beth Hart record and see what sounds the best.
That girl can sing, huh?
She's awesome.
Wow. I was so pissed off when they were pumping that clip of Jeff Beck doing Purple Rain, and every headline said, Steven Tyler joins Jeff Beck for Purple Rain. He doesn't sing one fucking note on it. She's up there murdering it at the Hollywood Bowl last week. Steven Tyler's just standing there.
Right.
I'm like, this is embarrassing, this actual headline. And I, you know what I mean? You know, I love Steven Tyler, but I'm just like,
it's criminal, you know, like,
it's just clickbait.
It really is. And it's so criminal. Like, you know, sometimes you just go, who writes this stuff and why? And I never, you know, there's always the criminally underrated. And unfortunately, Beth has been always underrated, but underestimate her at your own peril. She's one of the best ever.
She's a killer.
And we've done 3 albums. This will be our 4th album together in about 5 years. And she's just one of those people that should be a superstar. And in my opinion, will be a superstar if she just keeps doing what she's doing.
Yeah. You now, your new record is incredible. I really like the new record. That song, Drive, is so good.
Thanks.
And it's what a vibe that song has.
It's got the cowboy guitar. I've done a few songs with the cowboy guitar.
It's great. It's kind of Tom Waits vibe.
A little bit. Tom Waits, you know, is a you know, to me, a blues guy at heart.
Of course.
Those are blues songs, you know.
Absolutely.
They're just wacky, mesmerizing lyrics and very simple structures, and it's pretty much what Howlin' Wolf was doing and Willie Dixon and all those guys. So that the Blues of Desperation, you know, that record's come out really good, and it's actually sold really well. And you know, we've been very lucky that people have come out time and time again to buy the albums, you know, and I, God almighty, I never thought we'd get this far, you know, 33 albums in 17 years. And, you know, it's been really good. And, you know, the idea with blues is it's always been dead. Blues is always dead.
Yeah.
Blues has always been dead. Well, if you want to make the same old blues record, yeah, it's a tired genre. But there's no rules now. There never was.
Right.
And there's no rules. So if you want to make a blues record with cowboy guitar, if you want to make a blues record with, you know, Greek instruments or background singers or strings, it's all up for grabs because it's still entertainment. You have, you know, it's like you can't, you know, like a lot of people are kind of shackled to these old rules of like, well, blues ain't this. It's like, well, at the end of the day, okay, maybe the founding fathers said, you know, maybe the founding fathers didn't anticipate it, but B.B. King put strings on the Thrill Is Gone, and you know, It's actually Bill Simzik, but at the end of the day, it was his record, and it was the biggest, one of the biggest blues songs ever. The yeah. Bill's gone. So at the end of it, there is no rules. I learned from BB. It's like, there's no rules. Who cares? It's and the traditionalists, you know, want to run you out of town, but you go, you know, I'd rather play to more people, have my music appeal to more people than have this kooky ideal of
Yeah, you don't want to be at the baked potato all your life.
No,
you
know? And nothing wrong with the baked potato.
No, I know, I love it. I'm just saying though, you want to go out and you want to see the world, and you want, you know, you want people to hear music and, right. And enjoy their time out, you know.
And you know, draw a crowd and it is music business. You have to pay your players. You have to pay your band. You have to pay hopefully yourself at the end of the day. It's like you can't just you know, look at it from a very one-sided, you know, point yeah. of view of going, well, you know, if you're not keeping within this structure, it's not blues. And if you're not blues, then you can't call yourself blues. And then if you're not this, you can't do it. And it's like, well, like by the time you get done reading the rule book, you know, somebody else is taking your spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Gary Clark Jr. puts hip hop on his record. There's no rules.
Yeah, yeah, right. There's no rules. Were you really careful on not coming out as, like, there was a time where there was just everyone was the Stevie Ray Vaughan blues guy, you know?
Well, at the time, I was predominantly playing Telecasters and a Stratocaster.
Right.
And we were doing British blues, and I was doing like a Rory Gallagher kind of sound and everything. And we're doing British blues, and I had a SG and a Les Paul and for the heavier stuff. And I remember in Arkansas, it's about 2000. We play this little place in Fayetteville, Arkansas. I forgot. It was a little place, 50 people, whatever. And I used to have this little, I guess it was a gimmick, but I used to do a little Johann Sebastian Bach thing on a Strat with a volume control and make it sound like a violin.
Right.
And with a little DD3 boss delay. It
actually some Yngwie stuff?
No, it wasn't like it
was neoclassical.
No, it wasn't shreddy. It was like more like linear and, you know, and it's almost like a violin part, you know. And it would get the audience really quiet, and then I would go into a slow blues.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a showstopper. After the show, I'm packing up the van, right, which is style in those times. Packing up the van and putting stuff away and getting ready to head down the road. And this guy comes and goes, Joe, man, when you made your guitar sound like a violin, I figure he pegged the piece. He figured out what. He goes, man, when you were doing that, man, that certainly sounded like Stevie Ray Vaughan, man. You're channeling Stevie Ray Vaughan. I went, what? I go, I mean, like, I love Stevie, and I thought he was awesome. And it, so, you know, Reese Winans, his keyboard player, plays in my touring band,
right?
And on the records, and I'll see him in a couple of days. But anyway, I said, why in the hell would he say that? You know, and I started thinking about it. I go, it's that fucking Stratocaster.
Yeah.
I don't care if you go up there and play straight up polka music. But if you play it with a Stratocaster, you're going to get pegged as a Stevie clone.
That's it, right?
And, you know, at the time, to me, of all the people that do this stuff in the style of Stevie Ray Vaughan, by far the very best is Kenny Wayne Shepherd.
Yeah.
Kenny Wayne Shepherd is that guy. It's unapologetic. He is that guy. And he's by far the very, very best. Yeah. Okay. Then there was the second, third, fourth, fifth tier.
Johnny Lang.
Well, no, Johnny's more of a singer.
Yeah, yeah. He had a great voice. I think that was the downfall of Kenny Wayne to me was he couldn't sing.
Well, he's, you know, Kenny's still out there. He's playing. And,
oh, yeah,
and
he's playing. But, I mean, he had the other guy come out and do the blue on black or whatever it was.
Well, everybody thought Noah was actually Kenny singing, and it was it's tough. But it was. But Robin Trower did. He had a singer as well.
Right. Nugent had
Derek St. Holmes, yep. And you know, but ultimately what happened was there's so many beat up Stratocasters and Fedoras and super reverbs and tube screamers all playing bastardized original versions of whatever Cold Shot or Pride and Joy, and I go, you know, and it was so weird when I first went to England in 2003.
Yeah.
Four, whatever it was. I expected to go over there and everybody would be like, you know, Peter Green, and I was like really excited. I found that the English guys and kids had fedoras and playing the Strats, and yeah. I was like, there was this band called the Hoax, and there's these two brothers or something. One of them lives in Southern California. They were doing Stevie Clone stuff. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like
it was out of control for a while, right?
The light bulb went on my head. I said, Bonamassa, dig your heels in on this British blues thing because you're the only one doing it.
Right.
I figured I was the only one doing it, and it worked because ultimately, the stuff that I was doing once I switched from the Strat to the Les Paul predominantly sounded way more Britishy, and I was the only person at that time, other than the masters that were doing it, like doing kind of a rebooted British blues thing, and everybody else was kind of mired in this hook it out, you know, cold shot each other, and it was baffling, you know, and it was baffling, and
they all go down that rabbit hole of the Univibe, and you know, and the Dumble Amp, and the you know,
Leslie,
all that, and then they, like we said, at the end of the day, they don't have any songs. Stevie Ray had some songs,
had great songs.
He had a great fucking voice,
right.
And he killed it. Unless he had showmanship.
There was a point in time where the blues was, and I was guilty of this as well, where it was two verses and a 20-minute guitar solo until I met Kevin Shirley.
Yeah.
And my producer, Kevin Shirley, has been with me now 11 years. We'll be 11 years in December. We've done 20-some-odd albums together. And Kevin was really, really... He goes, yeah, you're a good guitar player. Yeah, you could sing a little bit. Your songs are terrible. Your band's terrible. That was high.
Yeah.
That was hello.
Yeah.
He goes, if you want to do something different in your blues, I'm the guy. If you want to do something with, you know, real drums, but we need to get songs. We need to get songs. We need to get songs. And he keeps, and honestly, it's the same speech every time. And songs, 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 songs. And all of a sudden, you know, with his kind of prodding, you know, I ended up stumbling upon A Ballad of John Henry, which is now a song I play all the time. Slow Gin was Kevin's idea. All of a sudden, we started to get this catalog of tunes that kind of also separated us from that lane of the
outside the blues standard box.
It's two verses in a 20-minute guitar solo.
Yeah.
And when you're done with the 20-minute guitar solo, repeat the first verse and then do another 20-minute guitar solo.
Yeah.
And you need six songs to cover an hour and a half. You know, insert Univibe here. You know,
yeah, like, insert Univibe here.
Yeah, and that's ultimately, I think it was ultimately a little bit defeating for a lot of people. So, you know, like, again, it was just my advice to artists, any, if they want to take it or they don't give a shit either way, is you've got to find your own lane. It's like, if you, I'm starting to see, like, you know, there's people kind of veering towards my lane. There's people veering towards Gary Clark's lane, veering towards Tedeschi Trucks' lane. It's like, that's not going to work.
Because
us three acts are at this
point. Already covered.
We're arguably the most successful blues acts of this age strata. Doesn't mean that if you do a Gary Clark Jr. clone record, you're going to be as big as Gary Clark, because there's only one Gary Clark.
Yeah.
He found the formula.
Yeah.
You know, Tedeschi Trucks has been chiseling. Yeah, I remember Derek when he had a solo band and a singer, and Susan was out on her own, and they've kind of amalgamated everything and come up with their own thing, which is great. I wouldn't want to pay their road bill with 11 pieces,
right,
and everything else, but good for them for sticking to it, because I took 11-piece band out last summer, and all it's five buses and everything. You know, it's like, fucking hell.
You just come home as a loss.
No, ultimately it wasn't that, but it was like, you know, when there's a two in the first number of your weekly expenses, and then there's five more digits before the decimal point,
Oh. You're
going, and that's every damn week. You're like, okay.
Wow.
It adds up.
At what point do you start to see, like, I mean, you know, as I played music for years and I do stand up, at what point do you realize people are starting to come see you, like, for Royal Albert Hall? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That, I mean, How does that start to happen? Do you start, you're playing for years and all of a sudden you go, wow, man, it's starting to happen. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, we were much bigger in the Europe and in England than we were here for a while. And then I did the Albert Hall thing in 2009. We didn't film it for PBS, but it ultimately became a PBS special. And then it aired here on PBS as part of their pledge drive. And it just lit up like wildfires. All of a sudden we're doing 2,000-3,000 tickets here. And it solidified both
wow.
places. And it's nice because
from PBS.
PBS, yeah.
Imagine
God
that,
bless
right?
Big Bird. I love Big Bird.
Yeah. Anyway. That just shows you how many people are still just sitting around.
Well, I tell you, it's Channel 8 is just as good as Channel 4 yeah. or Channel 56 because people are flipping through the channels. And you have 500 channels. Generally, now it's just this mindless political talk with mindless politicians and then mindless political analysts, okay? It's like, you know, Clinton and Trump can't trip and fall without five people on the left and five people on the right going, well, you know, that you know the trip was because of Benghazi. You know, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
shut up, you know? And so they're flipping through the channels, and all of a sudden they see this nerd kid yeah. with a Les Paul and Eric Clapton, and they stop and watch. And then they, thank God, they called up, and they bought tickets through PBS, which is like a donation, and blah, 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 blah. You know, the rest is history. So we've been doing this for 5 or 6 years, and it's been working out great. And ultimately, you know, I've been lucky enough to where I can go all over the world, and I draw basically the same amount of people everywhere we go. We played some arenas in Germany and the UK. You know, few arenas here. We'll do Red Rocks and bang out 10,000 people.
Red Rocks is dope, right?
And it's great. It's a great gig. But ultimately, you know, I play big theaters and I'm happy and I don't want any more out of life than that because, you know, if you start playing in the Selena Gomez sandbox, first of all, I'm almost 40.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that's a young person's game.
Yeah.
You know, it's like hits, radio hits and blah, blah, blah. It's constant pressure to stay relevant. I'm not relevant. I just play blues in front of 3,500 people that seem to like it.
Yeah.
And that's my story, and it's unapologetic.
Now, you went to Nashville and was doing some writing with people out there. Was that a gear to try to get on the radio or just some getting some... You worked with Jonathan Cain from Journey.
I worked with Jonathan Cain.
Who's an incredible songwriter.
Yes, and I worked with Jonathan Cain, James House, Jerry... Jerry Flowers, Jeffrey Steele, Gary Nicholson. It was a great experience. I've been working on the last two albums with these people, and they've been really, really good. And James House and I have written some great songs together, and he's been very, very understanding of my songs. Some of the things that I come up with, like Oh Beautiful, which is just, it was just kind of this short poem put to like spoken verse, and then this huge instrumental section. I'm like, when I pitched the song, he goes, what's after this? I go, you leave that to me, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's like, it's this kind of field holler blues thing with this Zeppelin, like, you know, solo, section, which has ultimately been really, you know, really successful. And we're good at that kind of unapologetic mid-tempo blues rock, you know,
right.
It's kind of our thing. So.
Before I get out of here. Black Country, what's going on? You doing that again?
Yeah, Glenn and I are going to start writing at the end of the month, and when he's back from his tour, and hopefully we will have enough tunes by the end of October to do another album.
You going
to
tour?
We'll do a few dates, one step at a time. He's like, let's see how the record goes, and let's see, you know, how everybody's scheduled, because it really is the five of us. It's Kevin Shirley, Jason Bonham, Derek. Myself and Glenn, and touring wise, it's got to be the four of us because that's the band. You know?
Right.
You can't do it any other. The other players, it's just it doesn't feel right.
Right. Anything that you haven't done, you want to do, like any singer, like, I mean, when I heard Paul Rodgers sing with you, I go, man, this would be great as a free tour.
That was a dream come true for me. Paul was a. Paul
that Beacon stuff is great.
Yeah, and you know, the fact that we did Fire and Water. And
how great did he sound, right?
No monitor.
I couldn't. Yeah, I heard he goes, no monitor.
No monitor. He just got a microphone and and went for it, man.
And he was even more soulful now than he was back then. It's crazy,
freaking
right?
Nature. And Paul is one of the best ever. And it's just unbelievable.
And John Hiatt?
John was great. Beth was great on that DVD.
I love John Hiatt. Everybody's into the slow turn, but I love the family record, Bring the Family, and Walk On.
Yeah, I mean, he's written some great songs.
God, that guy's a song smith.
National treasure. So.
Well, thanks for having me over, man.
Dude, thanks. I'm honored to be on the show. Like, a bunch of my friends were on your show. Jimmy Vivino, Derek Sherinian, obviously, and it's a great podcast, man.
Thank you.
Happy the nerds finally have a voice out there. And
oh man, and your gear is just killing me. You think one day you'll say fuck it and sell it all?
What are we gonna decorate the house with?
Well, yeah, you know,
the decor of the house is the amps. You know?
It's so funny because I was like you, when the stuff wasn't this much money.
Right.
I had like a one bedroom apartment, and you just come in and be like, "Well, that's my pyramid of matchless amps."
Yeah,
there's my Blackguard tellies, right. You know, and oh, here's my Les Pauls in custom color, you know. Right. And after a while, I just I got to do comedy. I'm gonna sell these, you know. I miss them all though. Like, I mean, not all of them. I miss that Murphy Paul.
Yeah. Honestly, it's one of those things where it you know, I rarely sell stuff. If I sell stuff, it's to fund other things, and it's self perpetuating. But you know, it becomes like a hoarder. I gotta be careful. I'm not a hoarder. Right now, this is good and organized, but it could be a hoarder.
Yeah. All right,
thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, man. And then you got your Instagram. Tell everybody. You got Instagram. You got your website.
Website and the Instagram. You just look for my name and a bunch of guitar photos, and that's me.
Yeah. All right.
People are starting to rip me off though. They're starting to nick my photos, and then they post them as they took them. Right. They're like just cropping them out. And I go, because I'd see it. You know, like any of the vintage guitar stuff I follow, and I'm like, I think that's my Strat. You know,
that's
like,
hilarious.
Like, I'm like. That's my
shag carpet.
Yeah, that's my green shag.
Well, shit, man. Before I leave, can I see the other three 59s?
I'll drag them.
Okay, I'm out. Thanks. Thanks, Seth.